Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the elections and about the extent to which on the Democratic side it's shaping up to be a duel down to the wire between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, which may end in a train wreck at the convention. We'll speak with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer to The Nation magazine, who covers national politics, focusing on the 2008 presidential election. And then we'll talk about the Bush budget and the exacerbation of the gulf between the rich and the poor under this seven-year misrule of President George W. Bush. We'll be speaking with Dr. Ellen Frank, who's a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston. Her work is focused on how economic policies affect the prospects of ordinary households. She's a contributing editor to Dollars and Cents magazine, a staff economist for the Center for Popular Economics, and has served on the Council on Monetary and Financial Policy at the Economic Policy Institute. Her new book is The Raw Deal, How Myths and Deficits, Inflation and Wealth Impoverishes America. And then in the third section of the first hour, we'll go to London and speak with Alex Duval, who's a researcher, writer, and activist on African issues. He is a fellow at the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard University and the director of the Social Science Research Council Program on AIDS and Social Transformation. In addition, he's the director of Justice Africa in London, and he's going to be talking to us today about the war in Chad, which is an extension of the war in Sudan. And we'll be talking about all of the players and refer to his blog, Making Sense of Darfur. Let's now begin with the subject of the elections, which are certainly proving to be much, much more interesting than one could have expected. And the indications are that the Democrats are breaking all kinds of records with turnout, which definitely bodes well for them in November. But, of course, in the last day, we've had election victories, a sweep, in fact, by Barack Obama in the Louisiana primaries and in Nebraska caucuses, the Washington caucuses, and the Virgin Islands. And in Kansas, of course, Mike Huckabee won and eked out a narrow victory also in Louisiana. Ari Berman, do you... one of the odd things about this race is that on the Republican side, so much is being said by the conservatives who capture the high ground and control talk radio and who don't consider John McCain a true conservative. And he obviously fails the Ann Coulter test. But on the other hand, it seems that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are both painting him as much as they can as a conservative. So which version of the McCain is going to resonate, do you think?
Well, hey, Ian, thanks for having me. I think in terms of McCain, the thing is that there's clearly a split between right-wing talk radio and some of the leaders in Washington and the GOP voters themselves. And I think what we're finding is that some of the hardcore conservative voters in the Republican Party were backing Romney or Huckabee or Fred Thompson when he was in the race, but really there are still enough independent voters, moderate voters, somewhat conservative voters in the Republican Party to propel John McCain to victory, which is why McCain can win. It's not all Rush Limbaughs in the Republican Party, clearly. Or it's people that listen to Rush Limbaugh and then decide for themselves. And I think they're seeing that John McCain is probably their best chance of winning in November, that he's conservative on enough issues, and that the big issue for him, the war on terror and the so-called surge in Iraq, is also the biggest issue for them, and that as long as there's a perception among Republicans that the surge is working, that will benefit John McCain, which is also why Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have painted John McCain essentially as an extension of George W. Bush, because McCain was the leading cheerleader for the surge. He's been incredibly hawkish on Iraq, and going forward says there's going to be more wars, has talked about staying in Iraq for 100 years. He has a 100-year plan to continue the war. And in general, on most domestic policy issues, McCain is pretty conservative. Now, he voted against the Bush tax cuts, but he has since said they should be made permanent. He won't say whether he'll vote for his own bill on immigration, which is sort of astounding. And generally speaking, he toes the economic conservative line, has people like Texas Senator Phil Graham, Jack Kemp, known conservatives around him on economic policy, and he's consolidated a lot of the Republican base in being able to go forward. So I really think that it's true that while conservatives have their problems with John McCain, in the end they will rally around him, and in the end either Clinton or Obama will say either Clinton or Obama will say that McCain is to the right of where the country is right now and is basically four more years of the same.
And Ari Berman, what do you think is happening with Huckabee? Obviously, he was Romney tried to get him out of the race, and he's basically said, look, that's presumptuous. And clearly, he is showing that he's got a lot of appeal in the Bible Belt. Not yeah. surprising, since he quotes the Bible so often. In fact, he's referred to his victory in the Kansas caucus as a miracle. He is more and more appears to be running up, banking delegates, if you will, to force his way onto the ticket as a VP. And so do you think he's getting a private phone call from McCain basically saying, stop spoiling my coronation or I won't put you on the ticket? Or conversely, is this enough leverage to force his way onto the ticket?
Well, I think there's a lot of conservatives who are still antsy about John McCain, and I think we're seeing that in Huckabee's victories, particularly in very conservative places like the South and in Kansas. I would say that the turnout in Kansas on the Republican side was extraordinarily low. I mean, Huckabee got something like 10,000 votes. So it wasn't exactly like a sweeping victory for him, although he did get a large percentage simply because almost no one showed up for John McCain. In terms of what Huckabee's going for, it's almost statistically impossible that he could win. And, because the Republican race is winner-take-all among delegates in most states, if John McCain, by virtue of winning states like California and New York and New Jersey, just has so many more delegates than Huckabee has, and there's much fewer that are needed to win the Republican nomination than on the Democratic side, that it looks like if McCain just holds strong in the coming days, he'll be able to win this thing. As far as the VP goes, Huckabee has his own problem with conservatives, strangely enough. The economic conservatives in the party view him with suspicion. Some of the major evangelical leaders haven't been too fond of him in the past, even though he himself is an evangelical leader and got the endorsement of James Dobson recently this week. So I don't know if McCain would be in his best interest to pick Huckabee, simply because Huckabee, while he does give you a portion of the evangelical vote, is still viewed with suspicion by some of the same conservatives that don't like McCain. So if McCain really wants to sort of firm up his standing with the Republican base, he's probably going to have to pick someone that's liked by all segments of the Republican Party, and that person is not Mike Huckabee.
Well, there are some other possibilities, Charlie Crist, but then Charlie Crist has got as much white hair as McCain does. That wouldn't make much sense, given.
And is a major moderate, too.
Right, and obviously he would need to get a more conservative, probably Southerner. Mark Sanford of South Carolina is a possibility. But the one name that you keep hearing, and particularly if the Democrats nominate Barack Obama, is Condoleezza Rice. Do you think that if that ever were to happen, finally, somebody will look at Condoleezza Rice's appalling record?
Well, I think so, and that would obviously be a very strategic decision that McCain feels like he could either cut in to the black vote or he could cut into the women's vote, which would hurt both Clinton and Obama. I think in the end he's not going to get either of those votes, though, because I think African Americans are not going to support Condoleezza Rice based on her closeness to George W. Bush, and I don't think women are going to support Condoleezza Rice if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama is the nominee, just because I don't think the majority of women are going to like her policies either. But it's an intriguing possibility. I don't think it's going to happen for two reasons. Number one, Condoleezza Rice is pro-choice. It doesn't get talked about very much, but conservative activists, I guarantee you, know that. And number two, she's never been a politician before. Where's the evidence that she can campaign? Where's the evidence that she can do the sort of retail politics that are needed? And it's just, it's going to show that in the midst of basically a looming recession or economic downturn, that John McCain, the only thing he's preoccupied with is war. And that's going to be a problem with him to begin with, his lack of knowledge or ability in, to talk about the economy, even though he's been in the Senate for so long, you'd think he'd get this stuff by now. And if he just becomes an Iraq-only candidate, the candidate of more war and less jobs, as Joe Scarborough of MSNBC once said, I don't see how Condoleezza Rice really helps him on that score.
Well, he's a train wreck that hasn't happened, I think, McCain, because he staked everything on the surge. And the more you learn about what's happening in Iraq from people who actually know Iraq, the more it's evident that the surge is a delusion, and that, in fact, round two of a much more nasty and pervasive civil war is about to start and may well start as early as April. So he's just going to be hung out to dry. But oddly enough, neither Obama or Clinton seem to be getting ahead of the fact that the surge is a delusion. They're still stuck in the way that all of them have been, going back to Kerry, to Clinton, to Edwards. They all voted for that fateful October 02 war resolution, and they're doing it again. They won't get out ahead of what's really happening in Iraq and be leaders and true opposition leaders by pointing out the folly of this war.
Well, I don't know if that's exactly true anymore. I mean, Obama obviously wasn't in the Senate at the time, but did oppose the war. He spoke in an anti-war rally in Chicago at a time when none of his fellow Senate candidates at the time did that. So he was pretty outspoken at the time. Now,
and that proves my point, Ari, because that's been the best thing he's had going for him.
Well, I mean, but I think if you look at his plan, you know, he says, you know, I'm going to get all combat troops out in 16 months. Now, you could like him to go further and say, I want to get all troops out within a year, but the fact is, that's still a pretty significant difference between him and John McCain. And when they've been asked about it in debates, you know, the last debate they had, both Clinton and Obama were pretty firmly against this notion that the surge is working. So I don't think they're going to get into a agreement with John McCain on this issue. I think both of them are staking the claim that the surge isn't working and that we need to begin pulling our troops out. I think Clinton may have a slightly harder time making that argument, just because for a long time her position did closely mirror John McCain, and her opposition to the war has grown as her candidacy has taken off.
And as she's been more and more challenged from the left by
exactly.
Obama, you know.
And Obama hasn't been as outspoken on the war as a lot of anti-war people would have liked. But he's always been pretty consistently opposed to it. And generally speaking, you know, his plan has been well received. Now, I think there are some segments of the Democratic Party and the Democratic base that wish he'd go further. But I think what he's saying about Iraq will be acceptable to the American people as a whole.
Well, let's turn, Ari Berman, to the Democratic, what could be a train wreck at their convention, assuming that the two candidates remain neck and neck in the delegate count. There's an expectation that the Potomac elections on Tuesday will help Clinton get a little bit further ahead, but they're really still very close on the pledge delegates. Obviously, the concern amongst many rank-and-file Democrats is that at the convention, the superdelegates will then decide, and this would be an example of the backroom politics transcending the will of the electorate. And there could be a lot of bitterness, and if Hillary Clinton tries to seat the Michigan delegation, of course, Obama did not campaign in Michigan because it was the Democratic Party said not to. And the same is true in Florida, but Clinton managed to get on the ballot in both places. So do you expect this to get acrimonious?
No, I think that's a nightmare scenario that you just laid out, but I don't think it's going to get there. Just because if you look at Obama in the last week, for example, you know, he won all of the major contests, you know, Nebraska, Washington, and Louisiana. He looks like he's going to win on Tuesday night all the Potomac primary states, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And going forward, he seems like he's going to do well in Hawaii, which, of course, is where he was born, and then probably Wisconsin on February 19th. So that leaves March 4th as a very big day in terms of Ohio and Texas. And Clinton basically is saying, I'm putting all my chips on those two states. Now, I think if that happens, and those states really become a referendum on Clinton's future, if she loses those states, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on her to withdraw, even if it's a close delegate race, because the perception will be that Obama has won so many states in a row now, or close to it, if he does that, that regardless of the delegates, that the will of the voters has spoken, and that he's emerged the lead, and that for the good of the party, she needs to step aside. Now, I'm not sure that'll happen, but I'm just saying that's one scenario. The other scenario is that Clinton does better than expected on Tuesday, is able to win Ohio and Texas and Rhode Island on March 4th, and then you have a huge gap until the next state, which is Pennsylvania, on April 22nd. That's a ton of time. And I think during that period of time, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Democrats to try to get some sort of resolution. That's what Howard Dean was saying when he said we need to try to broker an agreement. It's not that they're going to broker an agreement where one person is vice president and the other is president, but their convention doesn't happen until Labor Day. Remember, it's very, very late. And this idea that you're going to have a horribly divided Democratic Party going into Labor Day, that you're going to have a convention that could be decided by party insiders, and that you're going to be able to come out then with only a few months then to be able to fight John McCain, who by all expectations will be a tough general election candidate for either of the Democrats. That just seems like a scenario where the party would throw away all the enthusiasm, all the momentum, all the advantages they've built up in this contest. So I just don't think it's going to come to this. Now, it's going to be harder to get Clinton out of the race simply because she's Clinton. I mean, she has the establishment support to an extent. Bill Clinton is not going to bow out easily. And so it would seem easier for Obama to be pushed aside. But at the same time, Obama's the one who's winning now more than Clinton. So if anything, he is moving into, if he does well on Tuesday, to becoming the front runner. So this is why I think that for all the talk of the delegate count, I think in the end this is not going to be simply about delegates. It's also going to be about the perception of who's winning and the need for the party to go forward with a nominee sooner rather than later.
So in essence, Ari Berman, you're suggesting that obviously, as long as this race goes on, there's more press attention, more energy, more enthusiasm, much, much more people showing up. It's got all the Republicans concerned. There's, in fact, more people showing up, almost double in every case than the Republicans. So that is bringing people in and keeping it alive. And all that is good for the Democrats. But after Pennsylvania, they've got to make a deal. And it's either going to be Clinton gets out if she's behind, or Obama becomes the VP if Clinton's ahead. Is that...
I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, I don't think that Clinton is going to choose Obama, and I don't think Obama would choose Clinton as their vice president. Not only because of you know the fact that they don't seem to like each other very much, but also.
Well, by the way, he went out of his way to say how much he liked her at the Jefferson Davis dinner.
Yeah, he said that, but I don't think it's true. And I think in general, they don't really balance each other out well. If Clinton is the nominee, she's probably going to pick a white man with a lot of national security experience. And if Obama is the nominee, he's going to pick someone who fits his message of change, whether that be a white woman, a white man, who knows. But it doesn't seem like Hillary Clinton would be that person. Either way, I would say, you know, the governor of Kansas, Catherine Sebelius, the governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, and someone like that would probably be more fitting than Hillary Clinton, or someone like Tim Kaine, you know, the governor of Virginia, or Jim Webb, senator from Virginia, someone like that. I think what's going to happen, though, is that if you look at what it would mean for it to go to the convention, they'd both be broke, essentially, by the time they got there, if it went this long. There would not be a resolution that's going to be acceptable to either side. How would all the African Americans, all the young people, all the independent voters who staked so much on Obama feel if Clinton won in some insider manner? That would really turn people off. On the other hand, how would the Clinton people feel if they felt like they were gypped out of a nomination? So I just think that this scenario where it goes down to the convention, I just think is going to be bad for both sides in the end, which is why I think, although it hasn't happened yet, that at some point someone is going to get some momentum here, and it may happen in the next few weeks, and it may render all this talk of delegates somewhat less relevant if there's really a perception that one candidate is significantly beating the other in the popular vote and the general consensus.
Well, that will be a hard pill for both sides to swallow, I should think, and particularly given that Obama on a number of occasions has said that he can see that people that vote for Hillary would have no trouble voting for him, but he's not sure that his people would want to vote for her. And I think you're reinforcing that by suggesting that the new people that are coming into the process, the young voters for the first time, would be easily disillusioned, and that would be a tragedy for the Democrats to lose that brand new constituency, which may change the entire mathematics of this election year.
Well, I think Obama does have a point when he says that. Now, I'm not entirely sure that there are some groups that she does well with that he does less well with. For example, she has a lot of support among Hispanics. Obama would have to work pretty hard if John McCain was the nominee to get the Hispanic vote. I think in the end he probably would get it, but I think it would be tougher for him. Will he be able to hold all the women voters that Clinton gets? Probably, but he's going to have to work for it. But she cannot win without African-American and youth support. It's just not going to be possible. And she's also not going to be able to win by getting independent votes. And if you look at John McCain, independent voters have always been his strength. They've been the swing voters of the last few elections. That's the reason why Democrats took over the Congress in 06, why they won in a lot of swing districts, was because independent voters decided to back them in very large numbers compared to 02 and 04. And what Obama's saying is basically, I'm going to keep the Democratic base that Clinton has, but I'm going to add new voters, I'm going to add independent voters, and I'm going to get black turnout like you've never seen before in places across the country. And that's going to allow me to beat John McCain. And I think we don't know. Again, I mean, I have a hard time making the electability argument because we just don't know what's going to happen when there's a nominee and what the Republicans will throw out them. But certainly from a demographic and a numerical standpoint, Obama has a more convincing argument than Hillary in terms of the new voters and the different kind of people he's bringing into the party.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Ari Berman.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Ari Berman, who's a contributing writer to The Nation, where he covers national politics, focusing on the 2008 presidential election. He is also an investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute, and his articles about the presidential race may be read at www.thenation.com. I'm now speaking with Dr. Ellen Frank, who is a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Her work has focused on how economic policies affect the prospects of ordinary households. She is a contributing editor to Dollars and Cents magazines, a staff economist for the Center for Popular Economics, and has served on the Council on Monetary and Financial Policy at the Economic Policy Institute. Her new book, The Raw Deal, How Myths About Deficits, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverishes America, was published by Beacon Press in 2004. It argues for a return to a strong pro-employment fiscal policy in the United States. And with this, I don't think I've ever seen a budget submitted by a president that has been less underwhelming than this last budget. I mean, are we living in an alternative universe to George W. Bush?
Thanks, Ian. I think that for people who are progressively minded, George Bush's budget is, you know, quite an upsetting document. And I think it's important to emphasize that there is no more political document than the budget document. I mean, it reflects people's priorities. It reflects what they think is important. And in this budget, Bush proposes to cut domestic programs by about $500 billion over the next 5 years, at the same time increasing tax cuts and making tax cuts permanent, which will cost about $900 billion over 5 years. So we see cuts to Medicare, cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, cuts to Section 8 housing, cuts to child care assistance, cuts to the low-income energy assistance program, and even reductions in the needs of the child's health insurance program, which of course, as we saw a while ago, was a very controversial issue, and at the same time making the estate tax cut permanent and other or completely eliminating the estate tax as was planned at the beginning of his administration, and other cuts to upper income taxpayers.
Well, I don't think though it's just the progressives that have, from what I've read in the press, editorial writers on all kinds of newspapers, economists. Nobody's much suggested that this is a particularly realistic budget, because surely, let's begin with the one item that you didn't mention, but will probably get a lot of attention: zeroing out public broadcasting. That one's going to definitely be fought, right?
Right, and these have been conservative priorities for years.
So it's just you think it's a ritual that this is reflecting, that they just throw a bone to the conservatives?
You know, possibly. I mean, certainly this budget is unlikely to pass the House, but I think the budget reflects Bush's priorities, and these genuinely are Bush's priorities. You know, he has said time and time again, as have many on the conservative wing of the Republican Party, that the answer for the U.S. economy is tax cuts and more tax cuts, that those tax cuts should be targeted toward the upper income groups, since they are the ones that invest and create jobs, and that programs that benefit low-income people should be, and programs that are simply expenditure of government money on things that are seen as unnecessary, like public broadcasting, should be cut, because those simply encourage people to not work.
Well, if obviously the Congress is not going to they're going to fight this one, but meanwhile, back in the real world, surely there's indications that the economy is getting worse. You get the feeling that nobody quite knows where the subprime thing's going to bottom out. It's still, to me, absolutely mystifying that the so-called ninja loans, no income, job, or assets, could have been suddenly repackaged into AAA guaranteed securities and sold all around the world. And the people who did this sleight of hand all got handsomely compensated for it. And now nobody knows who's hiding what. The banks aren't lending to each other. So it seems to be that we don't really know how this economy is going to bottom out.
We don't know. And, you know, the subprime mortgage lending mess is something that we don't know how far it's going to go, or how deep it's going to go, or how much it's going to end up costing the financial industry when all is said and done. And this is partly because people don't fully understand these collateralized debt obligations that were, you know, these bundles of mortgages and other kinds of securities backed by payments on auto loans and things like that. But the mortgage market obviously has been the most troubled market, and there are very complex instruments that have been that nobody knew exactly how to price. And one of the consequences of that is that the economy does appear to be going into recession. I'm sure there are other reasons besides the subprime mortgage crisis. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very concerned about is the response, not just by the Bush administration, but also by the Democratic legislature, to the threat of a recession. I am not happy about the stimulus package and the tax rebates to, mostly as the Democrats proposed, to working families and working households. The Senate is now proposing to extend that to the Social Security and Social Security disability recipients. But right now, the states really need help, and the states are responsible for most economic programs that people depend upon. And without government, without federal help, you're going to see cuts at the state level in Medicaid spending, also in child care assistance, which the states mostly pay for and operate, and other cuts in housing and other things that help low-income people in particular.
Well, what would help low-income people, and the idea, I imagine, in a stimulus is to inject money as quickly as possible. Surely extending unemployment benefits would do that.
Well, extending unemployment benefits would do that, and I certainly don't oppose that, but getting money into taxpayers' hands will first of all take several months.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, whereas getting money into state coffers would be spent almost immediately. Right now we're seeing a return to the bad old days of 2001, 2002, 2003, when most of the states were in fiscal crisis and had to make really dire cuts in programs and in education spending and other programs funded by state and local taxes.
Dr. Ellen Frank, since your research focuses on how economic policies affect the prospects for the ordinary household, I'm sort of a little bit perplexed why there's a certain passivity in our electorate about the unfairness of the Bush regime and the general unfairness which is manifested by the gulf between the rich and the poor, and particularly between corporate salaries, CEO salaries, and the workers on the shop floor. We have the dubious distinction of having the greatest disparity in that income gap in the world, and it's growing. And, of course, the people who are being affected by this subprime meltdown, normally working class people trying to sort of eke their way into the middle class, and they're going to all be basically jettisoned back into whatever they can pull together. And it just seems particularly cruel.
Housing and such, yes.
It seems particularly cruel that they should be the victims of this heist by these people on Wall Street.
Well, you know, the question of why Americans are, you know, appear to be passive about this or indifferent or simply not willing to take an active and strong stance against these policies that have enriched the upper income people tremendously, while, you know, severely squeezing the middle class, is a complicated question, and I think a lot of it has to do with exactly the kind of ambition that you mentioned in the subprime mortgage market, the ambition of people with low incomes to become middle class, the ambition of middle class people to become upper class, and the ambition of upper class people to become, you know, stupendously wealthy. There's a culture in America of, you know, feeling that remarking on or criticizing someone else's income, especially if it being too high, is, you know, sour grapes, and is, you know, unethical and unpalatable and, you know, unsocial. And, you know, and so I think this cultural, you know, belief in the American dream and, you know, getting by if there's enough opportunity and, you know, transcending one's economic background, these are things that make people very cautious about criticizing or getting upset about the distribution of wealth. I myself have taught economics for years and years, and when I ask students what they think of Bill Gates' wealth, for example, which is, you know, of course, as most people know, in the $40 to $60 billion range, they say, well, he worked hard for it. And that's where people come from, usually in the United States.
Well, you would think as more and more people felt the squeeze, the gasoline going up, they're maxed out of their credit cards, they're on variable mortgages, you would think that there'll be a little outrage. Ellen, what happened to the Protestant ethic about work and producing things? I mean, the people on Wall Street who swindle all of those poor, striving people, they just churn paper around. At the end of the day, they don't produce anything, do they, except profit for themselves?
Well, they produce profit for themselves, obviously. They also produce a, you know, fair amount of jobs, but not nearly as much as other industries. You know, they sort of are very important in the New York economy, for example, in terms of job creation. But I think that people are getting upset about this, and particularly the oil crisis. The subprime mortgage issue, not as much as I would imagine. I've heard a number of people express the view that people who got themselves into this situation were, you know, were not willing to to forego buying a home, even though they couldn't afford it, and it's nobody's fault but their own. It's surprising how many people feel that way. But the oil prices are really upsetting people. There's a real concern out there, I believe, that the speculators are manipulating the market and driving prices up higher than they need to be. People are feeling very squeezed, and especially in the face of a coming recession, when consumer confidence is dropping and job creation has really slowed, that's when people get upset, when they feel that the economy is working in ways that don't allow them to pursue opportunities because there aren't enough opportunities available.
Well, again, I may sound like a bush basher, but I get the impression that what George Bush has unleashed. I remember back in the days of Ronald Reagan, he ran on this bogus campaign that he would take the handcuffs off the millionaires and put the handcuffs on the welfare queens. And of course, the welfare queens were a myth. We know the beginning of this huge debt was run up. In Bush's case, it seems to me that he's empowered people like the Halliburtons of this world and the payday lenders that Tom DeLay was so kind to when he was in the House. You get the feeling that the bottom feeders have done well out of the Bush regime. But America itself, in terms of innovation and all the big corporations, I understand, are making more money abroad where they hide their taxes and avoid taxes, but not much is happening at home.
Yeah, and more to the point, they're creating jobs abroad and slashing jobs here, and that's been true now since the mid-80s, or especially since the early 90s, when the trade agreements started to be passed, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the World Trade Organization was established. And so, and people are upset about that, but I don't think that people quite know what to do about it. I think people are angry at big companies who they see as pursuing interests that are not consistent or compatible with the public interest. I do think that people are tiring, obviously, of this pro-business, these endless pro-business policies and the lack of attention to fundamental human needs such as health care. And that is probably certainly why people are moving, not to mention the discontent about the Iraq war. This is certainly why people are moving over to the Democratic Party, and I think it will give the Democrats a strong edge in the upcoming elections.
Well, I think if the economy keeps going south, and if the war in Iraq, which I've spoken to a number of intelligence people who actually know about the situation in Iraq, and they're suggesting that the surge is a complete delusion and things are actually going to get infinitely worse starting in a month or so. So on their plate, they would seem to be having an uphill battle. But do you feel that people sort of see the big picture, like we dug a hole in the sand in Iraq and poured $1 trillion or perhaps $2 trillion into a hole, and we're borrowing Chinese savings to keep this party going, and you better believe that in the last few years the Chinese haven't been digging a hole and throwing their money away. They've been investing in their own people and their own economy.
I think that people do see that, and I think that the discontent with the Iraq war has really opened people's eyes. And we see this in polling numbers where Americans say that they are becoming more concerned about the state of health care and education and less concerned about the threat of terrorism and would like to see more attention paid to that at the federal level. Furthermore, if the federal government doesn't do this, if it doesn't relieve some of these healthcare problems and education problems that state and local governments and individual taxpayers are facing, what we're going to see is a crisis at the state and local level because the states cannot simply not afford to fund the Medicaid program at the rate they're funding it, which is the program that supports low income insurance for low-income people. And there's a lot of you know, real concern about these cuts to the children's health insurance program, because it's just raising the number of the uninsured. And I think that if the federal government doesn't do something, it's going to create such a crisis all around, just both for individuals who are losing their private health care and for state governments that can no longer afford to extend Medicaid benefits. And that's going to increase the discontent with this, you know, with the priorities of the Republican administration.
I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. Ellen Frank.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Dr. Ellen Frank, who's a visiting professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. She's an economist who has written a book, The Raw Deal, How Myths and About Deficits, Inflation, and Wealth Impoverishes America. I'm now speaking with Alex Duval, who's a researcher, writer, and activist on African issues. He is a fellow at the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard University and the director of the Social Science Research Council programs on AIDS and social transformation. In addition, he's a director of Justice Africa in London. In his career, he studied the social, political, and health dimensions of famine, war, genocide, and the HIV/AIDS epidemic, especially in the Horn of Africa. He has been at the forefront of mobilizing African and international response to these problems. Dr. Duval received his PhD in social anthropology from Oxford University, with his thesis being a study of the famine of 1984-1985 in Darfur, Sudan. In 2004, Alex returned to his earliest research interest, Darfur. During 2005 and 2006, he was seconded to the African Union mediation team for the Darfur conflict and remains closely involved with the search for a lasting solution to the crisis in Darfur. Alex Duval's blog is Making Sense of Darfur. And just as we were perhaps trying to make sense of Darfur, Alex, it suddenly gets more and more complicated now with a war in Chad that is clearly connected to Sudan, and you get the impression that there's been a lot of revolving chairs here in terms of who supported who, and the guy that the Sudanese surrogates are trying to kill was actually on the Sudanese and Libyan payroll not so long ago. So walk us through this complicated revolving chair.
Simple it isn't. It is a remarkably complicated war, and I think increasingly we have to see that the Chadian war and the war in Darfur as one and the same war, because as far as the Sudan government is concerned, not only does it have the military objective of defeating the rebels in Darfur, but it has the military objective of defeating the government that is supporting them, which is the government in Chad. And the Chad government has exactly the opposite objective. And the largest group of Darfur rebels militarily active are from the same tribe, the Zaghawa tribe, as President Idris Deby, who live on both sides of the border. And in the last battle for N'Djamena, what we saw was Darfur rebels fighting alongside their Chadian compatriots, defending the Chadian capital against the rebels who were supported by the Sudanese government. And as you say, people keep switching sides. So the conflict in Darfur has very often been described as Arab versus African or non-Arab. And yet in the Chad conflict, what we see is that the rebels were led by a coalition of the Zaghawa, who were Africans, non-Arabs, and Arabs, and a lot of the Darfur Arabs have meanwhile switched to the other side. So, yes, musical chairs and a horribly complicated war, which has its roots going back many decades.
And prior to the current military leader, or thug, I think would be more accurate, his predecessor was finally removed. I believe he's in a jail somewhere in a neighboring country. But he created a kind of mini genocide as he left. And the impression you get that this guy could do the same if the French weren't propping him up.
Well, he might even do the same with the French propping him up. I mean, the history of this goes back to really one of the most important untold covert wars of the 1980s. President Ronald Reagan had a particular personal animus against the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, who in 1980 tried to annex Chad to be part of Libya. And there was a terrible civil war in Chad. In many ways, very comparable on a slightly smaller scale to the war in Afghanistan. And what the CIA did with the French was they poured weapons into the groups fighting against the Libyans. And two of the people they supported were the man who then took power, Hissène Habré, and one of his main commanders, Idriss Déby, who is now president. And they defeated the Libyans, and they drove out Libya, and they drove out its proxy militias, who were locally called Janjaweed, and they drove them into Darfur in 1987, where they sowed the seeds of the current Darfur crisis. And but the same qualities, perhaps, that made the Hissène Habré and Idriss Déby such good warriors in terms of defeating the vastly superior Libyan army also made them extremely ruthless political operators. And when they turned on each other, Hissène Habré massacred the opposition, and he's now in jail in Senegal. He's been charged with war crimes, with 1,019 counts of murder, which is just the tip of the iceberg. And Idriss Déby doesn't have quite such a bad reputation, but he is comparably a ruthless figure. He is no Democrat, and he's quite capable of getting rid of his opposition in exactly the same way.
And how much is the division between the Muslim North and the Christian South, which is not other countries in Africa, even Nigeria have that situation, but walk us through that, because it's not entirely clear that that it is the South versus the North, because don't these two leaders you just mentioned, the ex and the current, come from the North?
That's correct. And the Chadian War started in the 60s because the French had given the all the civil service and all the government to the Southerners, and the Northerners rebelled. But as soon as the Northerners, who were predominant, well, almost exclusively Muslim, as soon as they took power, they fell out among themselves. And every government for the last 30 years has been led by a Northerner. And the civil war has essentially been fought by the Northerners, fighting one another. And they've all been Muslims, all from the desert. And the Southerners, who comprise the small majority in the country, have been completely excluded from power. And they've provided civil opposition, which has been regularly stomped upon by the military leaders. The Southerners also sit on very large reserves of oil, which are pumped out by, amongst others, ExxonMobil. But the cash, which was supposed, under a special deal negotiated by the World Bank, supposed to go for building schools and clinics and infrastructure, has actually just been put in the pocket of the president, and he uses it for buying off his opposition and buying arms.
Well, it is a pretty disgraceful situation, and clearly there's some realpolitik going on there with the French propping this guy up, and I'm sure ExxonMobil probably prefer to deal with a thug in his coterie rather than distribute the money to the people, which seems to be the model here. But let's broaden it out a little bit, Alex, to the broader picture. You mentioned that you can't distinguish the Darfur War with the Chad War. And it seems to me that all along, Khartoum has been playing us for suckers.
Absolutely correct. When Idriss Déby took power in a military coup in 1990, the Sudanese backed him, and there was a very simple deal there. It wasn't because he was an Islamist. In fact, he's quite a heavy drinker. Simply made a deal with Khartoum. I won't back any of your rebels, and you don't back any of mine. And under that sort of protection arrangement, he survived quite well for 10 years. But it came unstuck because he lost control of his own tribe, and his own tribe, the Zaghawa, were behind the rebellion in Darfur. And as soon as the Khartoum security figured out that Déby couldn't control his borders, couldn't control his rebellious tribesmen, they thought the only option is to get rid of him, as they had done to his predecessor with using Déby himself. And three times in the last 4 years they've tried, and a week ago they came incredibly close, really very, very close indeed to success. They just didn't quite manage it. And one of the reasons why they struck at that particular moment was because the Europeans were due to send a protection force to Eastern Chad. And the protection force has been presented as a force for protecting civilians that will be neutral in the conflict. But it only has an agreement with Idris Deby. It has no ceasefire agreement, no way of talking to the rebels. So the rebels, that is the Chadian rebels, supported by the Sudanese, see it as an enemy. And so they struck in the day before, literally 24 hours before the first troops were due to arrive, because they thought these people will not be protecting civilians, they'll be protecting Idris Deby. And let's be quite frank, I think they were probably right, because the majority of the forces were going to be French. And France is actually fighting on the side of Idris Deby. There's no pretense of neutrality there. So this actually is quite a serious challenge to this whole doctrine of let's send troops into the middle of a war to protect civilians. Can they actually do that without becoming part of the war themselves?
Well, the troops that are in there from the African Union have proven totally ineffective, haven't they? Have they not? And they've been humiliated.
I think that's correct. I wouldn't say they've been totally ineffective. In a few locations, they've managed to protect people. In some places, they managed to monitor the ceasefire. But the reality is that when you have two belligerents, a government and rebels, and in this case, actually, if you consider these two wars fused into one, you have two governments and their proxy rebel forces who are determined to fight. Unless you have a force in the middle that is as strong, as determined, and quite ready to take casualties, it really can't do very much. And I think that is the fundamental problem facing the African Union. And it's the same problem that faces its UN successor, the same problem that faces its European Union counterpart that is planned for Chad. And I think what the French have shown, actually, in the last week, is that if you're ready to play hardball, if you're ready to go in there with your helicopter gunships and your fighter jets, and you're ready to back one side and really give the other side a serious beating, then you'll be taken seriously. But if you just go in saying, we're going to be neutral, we're going to protect civilians, please don't attack us, no one will really take that very seriously, and you can't do very much.
So, Alex Duval, do you think that something will happen here to change this tragedy in Darfur? Because essentially what's happened is the Sudanese government has created facts on the ground through the surrogates, the Janjaweed. They've driven an enormous amount of their population into this no man's land where they're just sitting in the middle of nowhere, being very poorly protected by this African force. Even if the French gave them the refugees protection, it still doesn't resolve the issue of what happens to these people. They simply cannot live in this wasteland forever.
That's absolutely correct. And to give real protection to these people would require far more forces than the French are ready to commit. And the moment the Sudanese government is escalating the war, the other part of its war plan, along with going after the Chadian capital in N'Djamena, was to clear the rebels out of Western Darfur. In the last 48 hours, we've seen them doing that, and approximately 20,000 refugees, I'm told, have newly fled across the border into Chad. And I think what this tells us is that we need to solve all these problems at once. We can't say, let's have a short-term solution of protecting refugees while we get to grips with the longer-term political problems. We actually need to go in with a very heavyweight political approach to say, these are wars in which there's really no good guys. Khartoum is bad, Idris Deby in Chad is bad, the rebels on either side are either incompetent or utterly callous, and in some cases very bloodthirsty too. So let's sit them all around a table. Let's have the leadership, perhaps, of the French, who have shown that they're ready to really commit politically to this. And let's see if we can find a political solution.
Well, Alex Duval, I thank you very much for joining us. And I, again, recommend your blog, Making Sense of Darfur. Is that how do people access it?
It's on the Social Science Research Council website. So that's www.ssrc.org. Look for publications and you'll find the blog there.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Alex Duval, who's a researcher, writer, and activist on African issues. He's a fellow at the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard University, and his blog is Making Sense of Darfur. where he has been there as a with the UN, the Africa Union mediation team for some time. And I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.